I'll try.
Rebecca sat up straight, took a breath, and with a determined demeanor began.
First, it is true that I like attention, and that I first came to therapy upset about my aging and about no longer being stared at by men. So I may have been preening for Philip, but not consciously.
She turned back to the group.
So, mea culpa, I like to be admired. I like to be loved and adored. I like love.
Plato, Philip interjected,
observe that love is in the one who loves, not in the one who is loved.
Love is in the one who loves, not in the one who is loved.
That's a great quote, Philip,
Rebecca said, flashing a smile.
You see, that's what I like about you. Comments just like that. They open my eyes. I find you interesting. Attractive, too.
Rebecca turned to the group.
Does that mean I want to have an affair with him?
Nope.
The last affair I had just about did my marriage in, and I'm not shopping for trouble.
So, Philip, said Tony, you have feelings about what Rebecca just said?
I said before that my goal in life is to will as little as possible and to know as much as possible. Love, passion, seduction, these are powerful sentiments. Part of our hard wiring to perpetuate our species and, as Rebecca has just made clear, they may operate unconsciously. But, all in all, these activities serve to derail reason and interfere with my scholarly pursuits, and I want nothing to do with them. Every time I ask you something, you give me an answer that's hard to argue with. But you never answer my question, said Tony.
I think he answered it, said Rebecca.
He made it clear that he does not want any emotional involvement, that he wants to stay free and clear-headed. I think Julius has made the same point. That's why there's a taboo against romantic involvement in the group.
What taboo?
Tony addressed Julius.
I never heard that rule said out loud.
I've never put it just like that.
The only ground rule you heard from me about relationships outside of the meetings is that there be no secrets, and that if there are any encounters whatsoever outside the group sessions, the members involved must bring it up in the group. If not, and you keep secrets and almost always gums up the work of the group and sabotages your own therapy. That's my only rule about outside encounters. But, Rebecca, let's not lose the thread of what's going on between you and Bonnie. Check into your feelings about her.
She's raised some heavy stuff. Is it true I don't relate to women? I want to say no. There's my sister. I'm close to her, sort of, and a couple of other women attorneys in my office. But, Bonnie, you're probably putting your finger on something. There's definitely more charge, more excitement for me in relating to men. I'm flashing on college, said Bonnie, and how I didn't have many dates, and how dismissed I felt when some girlfriend thought nothing of canceling out on me at the last minute, if she got an invitation from a guy.
Yeah, I probably would have done that, said Rebecca.
You're right. Men and dating. That's what it was all about. It made some sense then. Now it doesn't.
Tony had been continuing to study Philip and approached him again.
Philip, you know, you're like Rebecca in some ways. You preen, too, but you do it with snappy, deep-sounding slogans.
I believe your point,
said Philip with eyes closed in deep concentration,
is that my motivation in voicing observations is not what it seems to be, that it is instead self-serving, a form of preening in which, if I understand you, I attempt to evoke Rebecca's and others' interest and admiration. Is that correct?
Julius felt on edge. No matter what he did, the focus kept going back to Philip. At least three conflicting desires fought for his attention. First, to protect Philip against too much confrontation. Second, to prevent Philip's impersonality from derailing the intimate discourse. And third, to cheer Tony on in his efforts to knock Philip on his ass. But all in all, he decided to stay on the sidelines for the time being because the group was handling the situation. In fact, something important had just happened. For the first time, Philip was responding directly, even personally, to someone. Tony nodded.
That's about what I meant. Except that it may be more than just interest or admiration. Try seduction.
Yes, that's a good correction. It's implied in your word preening, and thus you suggest that my motivation parallels Rebecca's, that is, I wish to seduce her. Well, that's a substantial and reasonable hypothesis. Let's see how to test it.
Silence. No one responded, but Philip did not appear to be waiting for a response. After a moment of reflection with his eyes closed, he pronounced,
"Perhaps it is best to follow Dr. Hertzfeld's procedure.
Call me Julius."
"Ah, yes. So, to follow Julius's procedure, I must first check whether Tony's hypothesis is consonant with my inner experience."
Philip paused, shook his head.
"I find no evidence for this. Many years ago, I tore myself free from attachment to public opinion. I firmly believe that the happiest of men are those who seek for nothing so much as solitude. I speak of the divine Schopenhauer, of Nietzsche and Kant. Their point, and my point, is that the man of inner wealth wants nothing from the outside except the negative gift of undisturbed leisure, which permits him to enjoy his wealth, that is, his intellectual faculties. In short, then, I conclude that my contributions do not stem from an attempt to seduce anyone or elevate myself in your eyes. Perhaps there are tatters of this desire left. I can only say I do not consciously experience it. I do recognize regret that I myself have only mastered the great thoughts, not contributed to them."
In his decades of leading therapy groups, Julius had experienced many silences. But the silence that followed Philip's response was unlike any other. It was not the silence accompanying great emotion, nor the silence signifying dependency, embarrassment, or bafflement. No, this silence was different. As though the group had stumbled upon a new species, a new life form. Perhaps a six-eyed salamander with feathered wings. And with utmost caution and deliberateness, slowly circled it. Rebecca was the first to respond.
"To be so content, to need so little from others, never to crave the company of others? Sounds pretty lonely, Philip."
"On the contrary," said Philip. "In the past, when I craved the company of others, asked for something which they would not, indeed could not give. That was when I knew loneliness. I knew it very well. To need no person is never to be lonely. Blessed isolation is what I seek."
"Yet you're here," said Stuart, "and take it from me. This group is the arch enemy of isolation. Why expose yourself to this?"
"Every thinker must support his habit. Either they were fortunate enough to have had a university stipend like Kant or Hegel, or independent means like Schopenhauer, or a day job like Spinoza, who ground lenses for spectacles to support himself. I have chosen philosophical counseling as my day job, and this group experience is part of my certification experience."
"That means, then," said Stuart, "that you are engaging with us in this group, but your ultimate goal is to help others
never to need such engagement. Philip paused and then nodded.
Let me be sure I got you right, said Tony. If Rebecca digs you, comes on to you, turns on her charm, gives you her amazing killer smile, you're saying it has no effect on you? Zero?
No, I didn't say no effect.
I agree with Schopenhauer when he wrote that beauty is an open letter of recommendation predisposing the heart to favor the person who presents it. I find that an individual of great beauty is wondrous to behold. But I'm also saying that someone else's opinion of me does not, must not, alter my opinion of myself.
Sounds mechanical. Not quite human, replied Tony.
What truly felt inhuman was the time when I allowed my estimation of my value to bob up and down like a cork, according to the regard flowing from inconsequential others.
Julius stared at Philip's lips. What a marvel they were. How exactly they mirrored Philip's calm composure. How steadfast, how unquavering, as they shaped each passing word into the same perfect roundness of pitch and tone. It was easy to empathize with Tony's escalating desire to ruffle Philip, but knowing Tony's impulsivity might quickly escalate, Julius decided it was time to steer the discussion into a more benign direction. It was not time to confront Philip. This was only his fourth meeting.
Philip, earlier in your comments to Bonnie, you said that your aim was to be helpful to her. And you've also given counsel to others here, Gil, Rebecca. Can you say more about why you do that?
Seems to me there is something in your desire to counsel that goes beyond a day job. After all, there's no financial incentive in offering your help to others here.
I try always to keep in mind that we are all sentenced to an existence filled with inescapable misery. An existence which none of us would choose if we knew the facts ahead of time. In that sense, we are all, as Schopenhauer put it, fellow sufferers, and we stand in need of tolerance and love from our neighbors in life.
Schopenhauer again. Philip, I hear too damn much about Schopenhauer, whoever he is, and too damn little about you.
Tony spoke calmly, as though imitating Philip's measured tone. It is breathing was shallow and rapid. Generally, confrontation came easily to Tony. At the time he began therapy, scarcely a week passed without a physical contretemps in a bar, in traffic, at work, or on the basketball court. Though not a large man, he was fearless in confrontation. Except for one situation. A clash of ideas with an educated, articulate bully. Someone exactly like Philip. Philip gave no sign he intended to respond to Tony. Julius broke the silence.
Tony, you seem deep in thought.
What's running through your mind?
I was thinking about what Bonnie said earlier in the meeting about missing Pam. Me too. I've been missing her today.
Julius was not surprised. Tony had become accustomed to Pam's tutelage and protection. The two of them had struck up an odd couple relationship, the English professor and the tattooed primitive. Using an oblique approach, Julius said,
Tony, I imagine it's not easy for you to say, Schopenhauer, whoever that is.
Well, we're here to tell the truth, Tony responded.
Right on, Tony, said Gil. And I'll fess up, too. I don't know who Schopenhauer is.
All I know, noted Stuart, is that he's a famous philosopher. German, pessimistic.
Was he 19th century?
Yes, he died in 1860 in Frankfurt, said Philip. And as for pessimism, I prefer to think of it as realism,
And, Tony, it may be true that I speak of Schopenhauer overly often, but I have good reason to do so. Tony seemed shocked that Philip had addressed him personally. Even so, Philip still made no eye contact. No longer staring at the ceiling, he looked out the window, as if intrigued by something in the garden. Philip continued. First, to know Schopenhauer is to know me. We are inseparable, twin-brained. Secondly, he has been my therapist and has offered me invaluable help. I have internalized him. Of course, I mean his ideas. As many of you have done with Dr. Hertzfeld. Wait. I mean Julius. Philip smiled faintly as he glanced at Julius, his first moment of levity in the group. Last, I harbor a hope that some of Schopenhauer's sentiments will be a benefit to you, as they have been to me. Julius, glancing at his watch, broke the silence that had followed Philip's remark. It's been a rich meeting. The kind of meeting I hate to bring to an end. But time's up today. Rich? What am I missing? Muttered Tony, as he stood and started toward the door. 20. The cheerfulness and buoyancy of our youth are due partly to the fact that we are climbing the hill of life and do not see death that lies at the foot of the other side. Foreshadowings of pessimism. Early in their training, therapists are taught to focus upon patients' responsibility for their life dilemmas. Mature therapists never accept at face value their patients' accounts of mistreatment by others. Instead, therapists understand that, to some extent, individuals are co-creators of their social environment and that relationships are always reciprocal. But what about the relationship between young Arthur Schopenhauer and his parents? Surely its nature was primarily determined by Johanna and Heinrich, Arthur's creators and shapers. They were, after all, the adults. And yet Arthur's contribution cannot be overlooked. There was something primal, inbuilt, tenacious in Arthur's temperament which, even as a child, elicited certain responses from Johanna and from others. Arthur habitually failed to inspire loving, generous, and joyful responses. Instead, almost everyone responded to him critically and defensively. Perhaps the template was set during Johanna's tempestuous pregnancy. Or perhaps genetic endowment played the major role in Arthur's development. The Schopenhauer lineage teemed with evidence of psychological disturbance. For many years before he committed suicide, Arthur's father was chronically depressed, anxious, stubborn, distant, and unable to enjoy life. His father's mother was violent, unstable, and eventually required institutionalization. Of his father's three brothers, one was born severely retarded, and another, according to a biographer, died at age 34, half mad through excesses, in a corner with wicked people. Arthur's personality, set at an early age, endured with remarkable consistency his entire life. The letters from his parents to the adolescent Arthur contain many passages that indicate their growing concern about his disinterest in social amenities. For example, his mother wrote, "Little though I care for stiff etiquette, I like even less a rough, self-pleasing nature and action. You have more than a slight inclination that way." His father wrote, "I only wish you had learned to make yourself agreeable to people." Young Arthur's travel diary reveals the man he would become. There, the teenaged Arthur demonstrates a precocious ability to distance himself and view things from a cosmic perspective. In describing a portrait of a Dutch admiral, he says, "Next to the picture were the symbols of his life story, his sword, the beaker, the chain of honor which he wore, and finally the bullet which made all these useless to him. As a mature philosopher, Schopenhauer took pride in his ability to assume an objective perspective, or, as he put it, viewing the world through the wrong end of a telescope. The appeal of viewing the world from above is already found in his early comments about mountain climbing. At 16, he wrote, "I find that a panorama from a high mountain enormously contributes to the broadening of concepts. All small objects disappear, and only what is big retains its shape." There is a powerful foreshadowing here of the adult Schopenhauer. He would continue to develop the cosmic perspective that allowed him, as a mature philosopher, to experience the world as if from a great distance, not only physically and conceptually, but temporally. At an early age, he intuitively apprehended the perspective of Spinoza's sub specie aeternitatis, to see the world and its events from the perspective of eternity. The human condition, Arthur concluded, could be best understood not from being a part of, but apart from it. As an adolescent, he wrote presciently of his future lofty isolation. "Philosophy is a high mountain road, an isolated road, and becomes even more desolate the higher we ascend. Whoever pursues this path should show no fear, but must leave everything behind and confidently make his own way in the wintry snow. He soon sees the world beneath him. Its sandy beaches and morasses vanish from his view. Its uneven spots are leveled out. Its jarring sounds no longer reach his ear. And its roundness is revealed to him. He himself is always in the pure, cool mountain air, and beholds the sun when all below is still engulfed in the dead of night. But there is more than a pull toward the heights motivating Schopenhauer. There are pushes from below. Two other traits are also evident in the young Arthur. A deep misanthropy, coupled with a relentless pessimism. If there was something about heights, distant vistas, and the cosmic perspective that lured Arthur, then, too, there was much evidence that he was repelled by closeness to others. One day, after descending from the crystal-clear sunrise on a mountaintop and re-entering the human world in a chalet at the mountain base, he reported, "We entered a room of carousing servants. It was unbearable. Their animalistic warmth gave off a glowing heat. Contemptuous, mocking observations of others fill his travel diaries. Of a Protestant service," he wrote, "the strident singing of the multitude made my ears ache, and an individual with bleeding mouth wide open repeatedly made me laugh. Of a Jewish service, two little boys standing next to me made me lose my countenance because at the wide mouth roulade with their heads flung back, they always seemed to be yelling at me. A group of English aristocrats looked like peasant wenches in disguise. The King of England is a handsome old man, but the Queen is ugly without any bearing. The Emperor and Empress of Austria both wore exceedingly modest clothes. He is a gaunt man whose markedly stupid face would lead one to guess a tailor rather than an emperor." A school chum, aware of Arthur's misanthropic trend, wrote Arthur in England, "I am sorry that your stay in England has induced you to hate the entire nation." This mocking, irreverent young lad would develop into the bitter, angry man who habitually referred to all humans as bipeds, and would agree with Thomas A. Kempis, "Every time I went out among men, I came back less human." Did these traits impede Arthur's goal to be the clear eye of the world? The young Arthur foresaw the problem and wrote a memo to his older self. "Be sure your objective judgments are not for the most part concealed subjective ones. Yet, as we shall see, despite his resolve, despite his self-discipline, Arthur was often unable to heed his own youthful, excellent advice. 21. He is a happy man who can once and for all avoid having to do with a great many of his fellow creatures. At the onset of the following meeting, just as Bonnie was asking Julius whether Pam was back from her trip, Pam opened the door, spread her arms, and loudly called out, "Da-dum!" Everyone, save Philip, stood and greeted her. In her unique, loving fashion, she went around the circle, looked into each person's eyes, hugged them, kissed Rebecca and Bonnie, tousled Tony's hair, and when she got to Julius, held him for a long time and whispered, "Thank you for being so honest on the phone. I'm devastated. So, so sorry. So worried about you." Julius looked at Pam. Her familiar smiling face conveyed courage and radiant energy. "Welcome back, Pam," he said. "God, it's good to see you here. We missed you. I missed you." Then when Pam's glance fell on Philip, darkness descended. Her smile and the cheery crinkles around her eyes vanished. Thinking she was jarred by the presence of a stranger in the group, Julius quickly offered an introduction. "Pam, this is our new member, Philip Slate."
"Oh, it's Slate," said Pam, pointedly not looking at Philip. "Not Philip Sleaze or Slimeball?"
She glanced at the door.
"Julius, I don't know if I can stay in the room with this asshole."
The stunned group members looked back and forth from the agitated Pam to the entirely silent Philip. Julius stepped in.
"Fill us in, Pam. Please sit."
As Tony pulled another chair into the group, Pam said,
"Not next to him."
The empty seat was next to Philip. Rebecca immediately stood and guided Pam to her seat. After a brief silence, Tony said,
"What's going on, Pam?"
"God, I can't believe this. Is this some monstrous joke? This is the last thing in the world I wanted. Never wanted to see this rodent again."
"What is going on?" asked Stuart. "What about you, Philip? Say something, what's going on?"
Philip remained silent and shook his head slightly. But his face, now flushed, said volumes. Julius noted to himself that Philip had a functioning autonomic nervous system after all.
"Try to talk, Pam," urged Tony. "You're among friends." "Of all the men I've ever known, this creature has treated me the worst. And to come home to my therapy group and find him sitting here, it's beyond belief. I feel like bawling or screaming, but I won't. Not with him here."
Lapsing into silence, Pam looked down, slowly shaking her head.
"Julius," said Rebecca, "I'm getting tense. This is not good for me. Come on, what's going on?"
"Obviously, there's been a former life between Pam and Philip, and I assure you, that comes as a total surprise to me."
After a short silence, Pam looked at Julius and said,
"I've been thinking so much about this group. I've been so eager to come back here, been rehearsing what I would tell you about my trip. But Julius, I'm sorry, I don't think I can do this. I don't want to stay."
She stood and turned toward the door. Tony jumped up and took her hand.
"Pam, please, you can't just leave. You've done so much for me. Here, I'll sit next to you."
"You want me to take him out?"
Pam smiled faintly and let Tony lead her back to her seat. Gil changed chairs to open the adjoining seat for Tony.
"I'm with Tony. I want to help," said Julius. "We all do. But you've got to let us help you, Pam. Obviously, there's been history, bad history, between you and Philip. Tell us. Talk about it. Otherwise, our hands are tied. Pam nodded slowly, closed her eyes and opened her mouth, but no words came. Then she stood and walked to the window, rested her forehead against the pane, and waved off Tony, who had started toward her. She turned, took a couple of deep breaths, and began speaking in a disembodied voice.
Over 20 years ago, my girlfriend Molly and I wanted to have a New York experience. Molly had lived next door to me since childhood and was my best friend. We had just finished our freshman year at Amherst and enrolled together for summer classes at Columbia. One of our two courses was on pre-Socratic philosophers. And guess who was the TA?
TA? Asked Tony.
Teaching assistant, interjected Philip softly but instantaneously, speaking for the first time in the session. The TA is a graduate student to assist the professor by leading small discussion groups, reading papers, grading exams.
Pam seemed staggered by Philip's unexpected comment. Tony answered her unspoken question. Philip's the official answer man here. Put out a question and he answers it. Sorry. Once you got started, I should have kept my mouth shut. Go on. Can you join us here in the circle?
Pam nodded, went back to her seat, closed her eyes again, and continued. So there I was at Columbia Summer School with Molly. And this man, this creature, sitting here was our TA. My friend Molly was in a bad place. She had just broken up with her long-term boyfriend. And no sooner did the course begin than this excuse for a man, she nodded toward Philip, starts hitting on her. Remember that we were only 18, and he was the teacher.
Oh, a real professor showed up for 2 formal lectures a week.
But the TA was really in charge of the course, including our grades. He was slick, and Molly was vulnerable. She fell for him and for about a week was in a state of bliss. Then one Saturday afternoon he phones me and asks me to meet with him about an exam essay I'd written. He was smooth and ruthless, and I was just stupid enough to be manipulated. And the next thing I knew, I was naked on the sofa in his office. I was an 18-year-old virgin, and he was into rough sex. And he did it again to me a couple of days later, and then the pig dropped me. Wouldn't even look at me, didn't seem to recognize me, and worst of all, offered no explanation for dropping me. And I was too scared to ask. He had the power. He did the grading. That was my introduction to the bright, wonderful world of sex. I was devastated, so enraged, so ashamed, and, worst of all, so guilty about betraying Molly. And my view of myself as an attractive woman took a nosedive. Oh, Pam, said Bonnie, shaking her head slowly. No wonder you're in shock now. Wait, wait. You haven't heard the worst about this monster.
Pam was revved up. Julius glanced around the room. Everyone was leaning forward, fixated on Pam, except, of course, Philip, whose eyes were closed and who looked as though he were in a trance. He and Molly were a couple for another 2 weeks, and then he dropped her. Just told her he was no longer having fun with her and was going to move on. That was it. Inhuman. Can you believe a teacher saying that to a young student? He refused to say any more, or even help her move the things she had left at his flat. His parting gesture was to give her a list of the 13 women he had screwed that month, many of them in the class. My name was at the top of the list.
He didn't give her that list, Phillips said, eyes still closed. She found it when burglarizing his living space.
What sort of depraved creature would even write such a list? Pam shot back.
Again, in a disembodied voice, Phillip responded. The male hardwiring directs men to spread their seed. He was neither the first nor the last to take an inventory of the fields he had plowed and planted. Pam turned her palms up to the group, shook her head and muttered, You see? As if to indicate the bizarreness of this particular life form. Ignoring Phillip, she continued, There was pain and destruction. Molly suffered tremendously, and it was a long, long time before she trusted another man, and she never trusted me again. That was the end of our friendship. She never forgave my betrayal. It was a terrible loss for me, and I think for her as well. We've tried to pick it up. Even now we email occasionally, keeping each other informed of major life events. But she's never, ever been willing to discuss that summer with me. After a long silence, perhaps the longest the group ever sat through, Julia spoke. Pam, how awful to have been broken like that at 18. The fact that you never spoke of this to me or the group confirms the severity of the trauma. And to have lost a lifelong friend in that way. That's truly awful. But let me say something else. It's good you stayed today. It's good you talked about it. I know you're going to hate my saying this. But perhaps it's not a bad thing for you that Phillip is here. Maybe there is some work, some healing that can be done. For both of you. You're right, Julius. I do hate you saying that. And even more, I hate having to look at this insect again. And here he is in my own cozy group. I feel defiled. Julius's head spun. Too many thoughts clamored for his attention. How much could Phillip bear? Even he had to have a breaking point. How much longer before he would walk out of the room, never to return? And as he imagined Philip's departure, he contemplated its consequences. On Phillip, but primarily on Pam. She mattered far more to him. Pam was a great-souled lady, and he was committed to helping her find a better future. Would she be well served by Philip's departure? Perhaps she'd have some measure of revenge, but what a pyrrhic victory. If I could find a way, Julius thought, to help Pam reach forgiveness for Philip, it would heal her, and perhaps Philip as well. Julius almost flinched when the buzzword forgiveness passed through his mind. Of all the various recent movements swirling through the field of therapy, the hullabaloo around forgiveness annoyed him the most. He, like every experienced therapist, had always worked with patients who could not let things go, who nurtured grudges, who could find no peace, and he had always used a wide variety of methods to help his patients forgive, that is, detach from their anger and resentment. In fact, every experienced therapist had an arsenal of letting-go techniques they often used in therapy. But the simplistic and canny forgiveness industry had magnified, elevated, and marketed this one single aspect of therapy into the whole shebang, and presented it as though it were something entirely novel. And the ploy had garnered respectability by implicitly melding with the current social and political forgiveness climate, addressing a range of such offenses as genocide, slavery, and colonial exploitation. Even the Pope had recently begged forgiveness for the Crusaders' 13th century sacking of Constantinople. And if Philip bolted, how would he, as the group therapist, feel? Julius was resolved not to abandon Philip. Yet it was difficult to locate any compassion toward him. 40 years before, as a young student, he had heard a lecture by Erich Fromm citing Terence's epigram written over 2,000 years ago. I am human, and nothing human is alien to me. Fromm had stressed that the good therapist had to be willing to enter into his own darkness and identify with all of the patient's fantasies and impulses. Julius tried that on. So Philip had made a list of the women he had laid. Hadn't he done that himself when he was younger? Sure he had. And so had many men with whom he discussed the matter. And he reminded himself that he had a responsibility to Philip, and to Philip's future clients. He had invited Philip to become a patient and a student. Like it or not, Philip was going to be seeing many clients in the future, and to forsake him now was bad therapy, bad teaching, bad modeling, and immoral to boot. With these considerations in mind, Julius pondered what to say. He began to formulate a statement beginning with his familiar, "I have a real dilemma," on the one hand and on the other. But this moment was too loaded for any stock tactics. Finally he said, "Philip, in your responses to Pam today, you referred to yourself in the third person. You didn't say I, you said he. You said he didn't give her that list. I wonder, could you have been implying that you're a different person now from the man you were then?" Philip opened his eyes and faced Julius. A rare locking of gazes. Was there gratitude in that gaze? "It's been known for a long time," Philip said, "that the cells of the body age, die, and are replaced at regular intervals. Until a few years ago, it was thought that it was only the brain cells that persisted all of one's life, and, of course, in women, the ova. But research has now demonstrated that neural cells, too, die, and new neurons are continuously being generated, including the cells forming the architecture of my cerebral cortex, my mind. I think it can be fairly said that not one cell in me now existed in the man bearing my name 15 years ago." "So, Judge, it wasn't me," Tony snarled. "Honest, I ain't guilty. Somebody else, some other brain cells, did the job before I even got there."
"Hey, that's not fair, Tony," said Rebecca. "All of us want to support Pam, but there's gotta be a better way than, let's get Philip. What do you want him to do?"
"Shit, for starters, how about a simple, I'm sorry?" Tony turned to Philip. "How hard would that be? Would it break your cheeks to say that?"
"I've got something to say to both of you," said Stuart. "You first, Philip. I keep current on the latest in brain research, and I want to say your facts about cell regeneration are off. There is some recent research showing that bone marrow stem cells transplanted in another individual can end up as neurons in some select areas of the brain. For example, the hippocampus and the Purkinje cells of the cerebellum. But there is no evidence of new neurons forming in the cerebral cortex."
"I stand corrected," said Philip. "I'd appreciate some literature references, please. Could you email them?"
Philip drew a card out of his wallet and handed it to Stuart, who pocketed the card without examining it.
"And Tony," Stuart continued, "you know I'm not against you. I enjoy your no-bullshit directness and irreverence. But I agree with Rebecca. I think you're being too rough, and a little unreal. When I first joined the group, you were doing weekend jail equivalent time on the highway cleanup patrols for a sexual assault charge. No, it was battery. The sexual assault charge was bullshit, and Lizzie dropped it. And the battery charge was phony, too. But your point?"
"My point was that I never heard you talk about being sorry, and no one here got on your case. In fact, I saw the opposite.
I saw lots of support. Help more than support. All the women, even you,
Stuart turned to Pam,
got turned on by your lawlessness. I remember Pam and Bonnie dropping off sandwiches for you once you were doing trash pickup duty on Highway 101. I remember Gil and me talking about not being able to compete with what was it?
Jungle nature, said Gil.
Yeah, Tony smirked. Jungle creature. Primitive man. That was pretty cool.
So how about giving Philip a break?
Jungle man is okay for you, but not for him.
Let's hear his side of it.
I feel awful about what Pam went through, but let's slow down. Not rush to lynch.
15 years ago, that's a long time.
Well, said Tony, I'm not into 15 years ago. I'm into now.
Tony turned to Philip.
Like last week when you...
Philip, damn, it's hard to talk to you when you won't make eye contact. Drives me fucking crazy.
You claim that it made no difference to you that Rebecca was interested in you. That she was, flirting. I can't remember that goddamn word.
Preening, said Bonnie.
Rebecca clutched her head in both hands.
I can't believe this. I can't believe we're still talking about this. Isn't there a statute of limitations to the ghastly, grisly crime of taking my hair down? How long is this going to go on?
As long as it takes, responded Tony, who turned back to Philip.
But what about my question, Philip? You put yourself forward as a monk, as someone beyond all this, too pure to be interested in women, even very attractive women.
Do you see now?
Philip addressed Julius, not Tony.
Why I was reluctant to enter this group?
You anticipated this?
It is a true and tested equation, replied Philip. That the less I have to do with people, the happier I am. When I tried living in life, I was drawn into agitation. To stay out of life, to want nothing and to expect nothing, to keep myself engaged in elevated contemplative pursuits, that is the path, my only path, to peace.
Well and good, Philip, responded Julius.
But if you're going to be in a group or lead groups or try to help clients work on their relationships with others, you absolutely cannot avoid entering into relationships with them.
Julius noted Pam slowly shaking her head in bewilderment.
What's happening here? This is crazy-making. Philip here? Rebecca flirting with him? Philip leading groups, seeing clients? What's going on?
Fair enough. Let's fill Pam in, said Julius.
Stuart, that's your cue, said Bonnie.
I'll give it a crack, said Stuart.
Well, in the 2 months you were away, Pam, Julius interrupted.
This time, why don't you just get us started, Stuart?
It's unfair for us to ask you to do all the work.
Right, but you know, it's not work. I like to give overviews.
Seeing Julius about to interrupt, he quickly said,
okay, I'll just say one thing and stop. When you left, Pam, it was a downer to me. I felt we had failed you. That we were not good enough or resourceful enough to help you with your crisis. I didn't like that you had to turn elsewhere, to India, for help.
Next.
Bonnie quickly said,
the giant issue here was Julius's announcement about his illness. You know all about this, Pam?
Yeah, Pam nodded gravely.
Julius told me when I phoned last weekend to tell him I was back.
Actually, Gil said, I want to amend that. No offense, Bonnie. But Julius didn't tell us. What happened was that we went out for coffee after Philip's first meeting, and he told us, since Julius had told him in an individual meeting. Julius was pretty pissed that Philip's preempting him.
Next.
Philip's been here about 5 sessions. He's in training to be a therapist, said Rebecca. And, as I understand it, Julius was his therapist many years ago,
Tony said.
We've been talking about Julius's, condition, and,
You mean cancer?
That's a shocking word. I know, said Julius. But it's best to look it in the face and say it. About Julius's cancer. You're one tough old bird, Julius. I gotta hand it to you. Tony went on. So we talked about Julius's cancer and how hard it was to talk about other things that were small in comparison.
Everyone had spoken but Philip, who now said,
Julius, it would be okay if you were to tell the group about why I first came to see you.
I'll help, Philip, but it would be better when you're ready to describe that yourself.
Philip nodded.
When it became clear that Philip was not going to continue, Stuart said,
Okay, back to me. A second round?
Looking around at nodding heads, Stuart continued.
In one meeting, Bonnie had some reactions to Rebecca's coming on to Philip.
Stuart stopped, looked at Rebecca, and inserted.
Rebecca's allegedly coming on to him. Bonnie did some work on her feelings about her self-image. Her sense of being unattractive?
And clumsiness? And inability to compete with women like you, Pam, and Rebecca, said Bonnie.
Rebecca said,
While you were away, Philip made a lot of constructive comments.
But revealed nothing about himself, said Tony.
One last thing.
Gil had a serious confrontation with his wife, even considered walking out, said Stuart.
Don't give me too much credit. I waffled. That resolve lasted about 4 hours, said Gil.
A good review, said Julius, looking at his watch. Before we quit, let me ask you, Pam. How are you handling this? You feel more on board?
Still unreal. I'm trying to hang in, but I'm glad to stop. This is all I can deal with today, said Pam. Gathering up her things.
I've got to say something, said Bonnie. I'm frightened. You all know I love this group, and I feel it's ready to detonate and blow apart. Will we all be back? You, Pam? You, Philip? You guys coming back?
A straight question, Philip quickly responded.
I'll respond in kind. Julius invited me to come to the group for 6 months, and I agreed. I also have his commitment for supervisory credit. I plan to pay my bill and honor my contract. I'm not leaving.
And you, Pam? Said Bonnie.
Pam stood.
This is all I can deal with today.
As the members left, Julius heard some comments about going out for coffee. How would that work, he wondered. Would Philip be invited? He had often told the members that extra group meetings could be divisive unless everyone was included. Then he noticed that Philip and Pam were heading toward the door on a collision trajectory. This should be interesting, he thought. Philip suddenly took note of it and, realizing that the doorway was too small for two, stopped and softly muttered, Please, and stepped back to allow Pam to go through first. She strode out as if he were invisible.
22. Sex does not hesitate to intrude with its trash, and to interfere with the negotiations of statesmen and the investigations of the learned. Every day it destroys the most valuable relationships. Indeed, it robs of all conscience those who were previously honorable and upright. Women, passion, sex. After his mother, the next most pervasive female presence in Arthur's life was a querulous seamstress named Caroline Marquet. Few biographical accounts of Schopenhauer fail to spotlight their 1823 midday encounter, which took place on a dimly lit Berlin stairway outside Arthur's flat when he was 35 and Caroline 45. On that day, Caroline Marquet, living in the adjoining flat, entertained three friends. irritated by the noisy chattering, Arthur flung open his door, accused the four women of violating his privacy since the anteroom where they stood talking was technically a part of his flat, and sternly ordered them to leave. When Caroline refused, Arthur physically forced her, kicking and screaming from the anteroom, and down the stairs. When she impertinently climbed back up the stairs in defiance, he again removed her, this time more forcefully. Caroline sued him, claiming that she was pushed down the stairs and suffered grievous injury resulting in trembling and partial paralysis. Arthur was highly threatened by the lawsuit. He knew that he was unlikely ever to earn money from his scholarly pursuits and had always fiercely guarded the capital inherited from his father. When his money was imperiled, he became, in the words of his publisher, a chained dog. Certain that Caroline Marquet was an opportunistic malingerer, he fought her lawsuit with all his might, employing every possible legal appeal. The bitter court proceedings continued for the next 6 years, before the court ruled against him and ordered him to pay Caroline Marquet $60 a year for as long as her injury persisted. In that era, a house servant or cook would have been paid $20 annually plus food and board. Arthur's prediction that she was shrewd enough to tremble as long as the money rolled in proved accurate. He continued to pay for her support until she died 26 years later. When he was sent a copy of her death certificate, he scrawled across it, "Obit anus, abit onus." The old woman dies. The burden is lifted. And other women in Arthur's life? Arthur never married, but was far from chaste. For the first half of his life, he was highly sexually active, perhaps even sexually driven. When Anthime, his childhood friend from the Havre, visited Hamburg during Arthur's apprenticeship, the two men spent their evenings searching for amorous adventures, always with women from lower social strata, maids, actresses, chorus girls. If they were unsuccessful in their search, they ended their evening by consoling themselves in the arms of an industrious whore. Arthur, lacking in tact, charm, and joie de vivre, was an inept seducer and needed much advice from Anthime. His many rejections ultimately caused him to link sexual desire with humiliation. He hated being dominated by the sexual drive, and in subsequent years had much to say about the degradation of sinking to animalistic life. It was not that Arthur didn't want women. He was clear about that. "I was very fond of them, if only they would have had me." The saddest of love stories in the Schopenhauer Chronicles took place when he was 43, and attempted to court Flora Weiss, a beautiful 17-year-old girl. One evening at a boating party, he approached Flora with a bunch of grapes and informed her of his attraction to her and his intention of speaking to her parents about marriage. Later, Flora's father was taken aback by Schopenhauer's proposal and responded, "But she is a mere child." Ultimately, he agreed to leave the decision to Flora. The business came to an end when Flora made it clear to all concerned that she vehemently disliked Schopenhauer. Decades later, Flora Weiss's niece questioned her aunt about that encounter with the famous philosopher and, in her diary, quoted her aunt as saying, "Oh, leave me in peace about this old Schopenhauer." When pressed for more information, Flora Weiss described Arthur's gift of the grapes and said, "But I didn't want them, you see. I felt revolted because old Schopenhauer had touched them, and so I let them slide quite gently into the water behind me." There is no evidence that Arthur ever had a love affair with a woman whom he respected. His sister Adele, after receiving a letter in which Arthur reported, "Two love affairs without love," responded in one of their few interchanges about his personal life, "May you not totally lose the ability to esteem a woman while dealing with the common and base ones of our sex, and may heaven one day lead you to a woman about whom you can feel something deeper than these infatuations."